This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
So what's your take on directing such a classic play, John, as The Children's Hour?
Well, you know, this is such an interesting project. A defunct very kindly came to me and wanted to do a project with me. And they had a play that we were going to do royalty things kind of fell through on it. And so I
so you were thinking
in a 24-hour, like, as Bethy was fond to say, well, let's not just do one play. Let's do two and wrap.
Oh, yeah,
it'll
that's
be really
easy.
Fun. It'll be much easier.
Sure.
So it was an interesting idea for a project because there are two plays I've always wanted to do, and I thought they're both such seminal works of gay literature, they don't get seen a lot. They're talked about a lot. People have heard about both of them, but very few people have actually seen them on stage. And I thought doing them together, there would be such a kind of interesting connection between the two of them to show how things have changed, how things haven't changed. And I think so many of the really deep and powerful parts of both plays, those matters haven't changed at all. I mean, I think there are still a lot of very challenging areas to being a gay and lesbian in America or any place else.
Well, it's an interesting examination of an earlier time. And do you keep it in that time period?
Oh, absolutely.
I think you would have to. Is it in the 30s, though?
It's set right when it was written. And Boys in the Band is also set in 68 when that was written.
Right. Well, I was just, you know, wondering, you know, in doing it as the 30s and to look at how far we might have come. I mean, it does seem like it's a bit melodramatic, but it's also, you know, I think important to remember as a Herstory project that this was at a time when it was unheard of, or it was something that was never spoken of and never mentioned. And it was so, I mean, it wasn't even in the closet. It was like non-existent.
Well, and I think also the play, you know, you have to always approach it from the organic place of who these characters are and what these particular people are doing and dealing with this subject. And so I think it's not a political treatise about lesbianism. It's really about Karen and Martha and Joe, the man in it, and how this impacts their lives. And the play is very much a thriller in some ways. The other major character, Mary Tilford, who is basically
the
Iago
child
in a petticoat.
Yeah.
She's just such a piece of work. The real, you know, one of the truly great villains of all time, and fascinating.
Kind of like The Bad Seed, which was another
very similar. Yeah. Well, that you know was written like 20 years later, and I think owes Lillian Hellman a little bit of money. So I think seeing how her lying and deceit and manipulation causes this to happen is really fascinating and definitely disturbing.
Well, yeah, one little lie, you know, mm-hmm. one little lie explodes.
And of course, you don't play it melodramatically.
I mean, you play it from
a real, real place. I think the film, that's one thing, it does veer into melodrama pretty strongly.
Have you updated it somehow?
No, I think play it for real, mm-hmm. you know, and try to find as much truth in it as possible.
Well, Grace Carter, you play one of the two teachers in the play.
Yes, I play Martha.
I thought you played Martha.
Yes.
And so how have you approached her character?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, I just love her so much have been just so invested in finding her journey and her truth. She's just meant a lot to me as a character. But how have I approached her? Well, you know, it has been interesting, actually, approaching it maybe from – it's not like it's a contemporary – necessarily like trying to make it contemporary, but you know, there's kind of the difference between maybe the way that it kind of reads on the page in this sort of melodramatic way and the way that you want to convey more of a truthful, maybe more honest way of depicting this relationship and this journey. And I'd say probably the biggest thing for me was to find, I think sometimes Martha can be a little stuck in one sort of zone. And so I've spent, and actually John's been great in directing this portion of it and just finding the joy in her and mm-hmm. her life.
You
and
don't
her
want to play the
excitement.
Ending.
Yeah, exactly. And even that final scene, I feel like we've kind of mined it more for just sort of the joy and the revelation of her of her being able to kind of be like, oh, that's what this truth is about the situation and me that I'm discovering in this moment, rather than playing too much of this sort of like, oh, I feel like horrible about, you know, myself. Mm-hmm. Although that is a piece of it that comes up, but more looking at it from the joy of discovering this, you know, about herself. So mm-hmm. I'd say those are the things that have been different or, you know, interesting in terms of the process. So,
well, I think it's fascinating that you're doing it at Defunct Theater. It's one of the most intimate theaters in Portland, and it has a 40-seat house. Mm-hmm. So how are you adapting? Is this supposed to be this boarding school with a lot of kids? Mm. And so how is that working out, John?
You know me,
What are some of the tricks that you're using?
Well, I would never say tricks, but
conventions.
I like to play with visual and all of that. So it created a really fun environment, and I have a wonderful designer, Megan, who's great, and we're doing it in the round, and it's a rather surreal depiction of kind of the inner state of the characters combined with the world of the play. So there's a lot of use of gnarled live tree branches with a lot of dead leaves, and there's a lot of use of a chalkboard imagery with writing on it, and the girls' school desks, which are among the audience members. So the audience is actually in the schoolroom with them, sitting next to those little Nazis. And then being in the round and kind of breaking up the audience so that you put them in different places, and it's not a smooth round, it's a broken up circle, and I think that helps to kind of really unease the audience a little bit, put them in a rather disturbing place where they always felt like they're being watched in much the same way as the characters are. So kind of creating that kind of oppressive atmosphere, which works great in that space.
You're really identifying with the two main characters.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was to not separate the audience from these people in either play. Right. And my God, in Boys in the Band, that's...
even more so.
Even more so.
Well, I would like to talk more about that, too, because I think it's fascinating. I do think that the Children's Hour does have something to say for us today.
Oh, absolutely.
What would that be?
Oh, I think both plays do. I think just how much... self-deception, not dealing with your own issues, and also just the power of other people's righteousness, other people's mm-hmm. thoughts, other people making statements about your life is very much a thing that I think is still very constant.
And I think it's important to note that it really is a journey for Martha. Mm-hmm. It really is a journey of her finding,
yes.
you know, albeit, you know, for good or ill of what happens,
absolutely.
Her own identity, her mm-hmm. own orientation.
Absolutely.
You know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's an interesting journey for her mm-hmm. in this play. And I think it's really crucial to it.
Yeah.
It really is.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what I was getting at when I was talking about going through the process with her and coming to the realization that final scene is actually a joyful sort of revelation her. I feel like everything sort of falls into place for her right there.
Good.
Sort of like, oh, okay. You know, like... And how that, then what transpires after that, her reactions to that or her feelings about that, you know, are very, you know, but definitely, absolutely, it's her journey.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. My guests are Grace Carter, John Kretzu, and Matthew Kern. And if you missed any of this show so far, you can hear it again on stageandstudio.org. The Children's Hour opens Friday, May 17th, and runs through June 15th at the Backdoor Theater at 4319 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland at Defunct Theater. All shows are at 7:30 p.m. For more info, visit defunctheater.com. And we have a pair of tickets to offer to the Children's Hour to the fourth caller. That's the fourth caller here at KBOO at 503-231-5106, 231-5106. A pair of tickets to the Children's Hour. A companion play in the Herstory History Project is another classic play from 1968 by Matt Crowley, and it was made into a successful film in 1970. And this is one of the first really realistic looks at what it's like to be openly gay in America. Mm-hmm. And it's set in an Upper East Side apartment in New York, and the plot centers around Harold's birthday party. Harold, a character, and all his friends and people at the party. So, John, you know, you set this in a really interesting way, You want to describe it? Because it's an on-site production, and I love those.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, I've been really, really into just, you know, tearing the envelope apart and lots of different types of things in work lately. And this was something that I wanted to do from the very beginning with the show, which is to put the audience at the party and in the space, in the room with the characters. And they are definitely, they're flies on the wall. There's only 20 only 20 seats.
Only 20 people can come to this house.
That's right.
It's basically you are in the living room of
you
the party.
You are
right?
On the wall, yeah, sitting along the wall in this party with the actors in your lap, basically.
Because it's not a small cast.
Nine people.
And
nine brave actors.
Matthew, you're one of the boys in the band.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's an actual band.
No,
you know?
No, there's no band.
Like you don't play an instrument band, but you are one of the group.
Mm-hmm.
One of the group. So who are you? What is your character?
I'm playing Emery, who is probably the most controversial character.
I would say.
Yeah. It's a piece that kind of, you know, was a big deal when it happened, and then quickly got turned on by the gay community after the Stonewall riots, and kind of was maligned by gay people for many years.
Because of the representation?
Because of the idea of it being stereotypical and representing a certain kind of gay person that I think as the movement went on, people were trying to distance themselves from. And now...
It's not a big deal.
45 right, years later... Right. We're kind of like, what were they upset about? Because I still know these people. I mean, there's lots of it that is, you know, data in the sense of that there's, you know, racist language that we would be more objectionable now in a polite company. But the basic characters and the things that they're dealing with and the self-loathing is a big theme in both of those plays.
Well, this is a time capsule, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wouldn't be fair to the time period nor the play not to present it more realistically.
But he is the most extremely effeminate character. Mm-hmm. And what I found really interesting in working on it is that there is so much homophobia against him within the group of gay men.
Right, mm-hmm.
And that is something that I think is... unfortunately alive and well.
Well, I think that there is that because there is that sense of you don't want to be a stereotype, but then what if that's who you are, you
right.
know? And the restrictions within a community,
sure.
you know, regardless of what community it is.
And I bristled at it when John said
that's
where he
character?
Wanted me to go.
That's your character.
And I had to really look at what that is about in me. And
so you had to really challenge yourself.
Yeah, and you talked about it as an exorcism in a way of doing this play.
Oh, definitely.
And I agree. Like, it's a lot of, like, staring at your own issues and doing something with them.
Yeah, it's a play that's haunted me since I saw it when I was in high school.
Yeah, tell me about that.
In a college production. And I remember just being kind of, you know, fascinated, repulsed, intrigued, titillated, and mostly going because, you know, at that point I pretty much knew who I was, and going, oh my God, is this the band that I belong to, and where do I find myself in all these people, and you know, I think as a young gay man or a lesbian, you're constantly looking for all that.
Well, you're
literature,
looking for a role model.
Anything
too,
you're reading,
you?
Everything,
yeah.
You know, you're reading every book, and seeing everything, and so this one really, you know, kind of took me unawares. And it was very good production, too. And I remember it very distinctly, and then seeing the film also. And so it's always just haunted me, this play. And I've always wanted to exorcise it by doing it, by, you know, immersing myself in it and doing it in a way that was so immersive for the audience so that they couldn't separate themselves from it. Because I think the play is very powerful whether you're gay or straight or whatever you are. I think it speaks to you in many ways, and it forces you to look at things you may be terrified about in yourself, your own prejudices, your own self feelings, all of that. You know, I think it really makes you look at yourself. And how better than to be in the room with the characters and not give you any way out.
Well, I like that the play, The Boys in the Band, is very immersive. You
yes.
know, you are going to be experiencing what it's like to be in this particular community,
mm-hmm.
you know, at this particular time
yeah.
and these group of characters.
At this event.
So I think it's fascinating that this was something you saw that was very had a lot of impact on you personally, John.
Oh, absolutely. Both you plays, know? I think. Yeah. So I remember seeing the children's hour on TV, you know, sneaking down late night TV. and they both had very strong impacts.
Wow. So the Herstory and History plays are culminating, too, with this summer's Pride Festival. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, Grace and Matthew as defunct members, you know. You decided to do these two plays, but this is a pretty big undertaking for this theater.
Amen. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think that says a lot to where you guys are right now that you can take on something this big.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And it was one of those things where when he was describing, like, we were going to do one play, and I can remember where I was standing in my living room and talking to him on the phone when he mentioned this project, and it sent this shiver of...
It's like one of those milestones in your life.
Terror and excitement of like, oh, that's going to be impossible, and we're going to have to do it because it's the exciting idea.
Wow. You know? Wow. Defunct Theater's Herstory History Project. I'm calling it a project because it really feels like that. I know you call it plays. The Boys in the Band by Mark Crowley and Children's Hour by Lillian Hellman, directed both by John Kretzu. And they run through June 15th, and all performances are at 7:30 p.m. And to purchase tickets and see a detailed performance schedule, you can visit defunctheater.com. I say that because it's defunct, but there's a T missing in the URL, so it's defunctheater.com. And the shows are in two locations. The Boys in the Band is performed on location at 3125. Is that okay to say where it is?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Please.
here it is, folks. 3125 Northeast Burnside in Portland. And the Children's Hour, which opens Friday, May 17th at the Backdoor Theater at 4319. Mm-hmm. Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, and that's also in Portland. And we have a pair of tickets to the Boys in the Band at Defunct Theater, and we'll take the fourth caller. These are really primo tickets because there's only 20 seats.
There aren't any of them.
503-231-8032, fourth caller for the Boys in the Band. In the final moments, I'm just wondering, you know, what you think these plays have to say right now, if you were to say it in like one sentence about where we are as a society right now. Because in your director's notes, John, you said something about how it may be, you know, that that gay and lesbian issues are in right now in the sense of topical and more accepted, you know, but it's good to remember these times past.
I think the press and the media are so in love with gay issues right now and trumpeting how positive it is. And
how far we've changed.
A politically correct statement.
It's like sort of the post-Obama racism attitude.
And that's wonderful, and that's very true, but...
Post-racial America, I'm sorry, not post-Obama.
It is still, I think, just as much of a challenge to be a gay and lesbian person in the world now. And I think looking at those challenges only makes you stronger and ultimately makes life a lot easier to deal with for both gays, lesbians, and straights and everyone else. Just kind of the plays are very human, ultimately. Mm-hmm.
Very human, and that's what we need more of in theater, just human theater. Well, it's been so great to have this conversation with all three of you, and congrats on the Boys in the Band has been well received with critical reviews.
Hallelujah. Nice reviews.
Very good reviews, and so we're hoping the same for the Children's Hour.
Definitely.
So thank you, John Kretzu, Grace Carter, Matthew Kern, joining me today and talking about the Herstory History plays, and have a great run of both plays.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Next up, we'll hear about the documentary Searching for Sugarman. The film is about two South Africans who set out to discover what happened to their unlikely musical hero, the mysterious 1970s rock and roller Rodriguez, who recently regained national attention. Filmmaker and videographer Justin Hartwick has this review.
Few film experiences capture and articulate an air of mystique that enthralls the audience into taking a Sherlockian journey through the corridors of the past. Although mystery and tension permeate many genres of fiction cinema, they seldom hit the mark in the documentary format. Some would say that there are too many stories in the world, there is no more magic hidden and waiting behind closed doors. But some would beg to differ. Malik Benjaloo, the South African filmmaker behind the Academy Award-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man, spent 4 years of his life seeking the truth in the middle of a labyrinthine myth. This story spans two continents and 40 years in search of a man. A man that could have rivaled the greatest musicians in an American history that never came to be. a man named Sixto Rodriguez. Western audiences seldom recognize his name before the Academy nomination of Sugar Man, yet Rodriguez could have been as much a household name as Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, or the Beatles. Simultaneously uplifting and tragic, the film follows Benjaloo's search for one of the heroes of his youth, whose 1970 and 71 albums were the highest-selling releases in South Africa at the time. For an entire generation of South Africans, the soundtrack of life was saturated by a prophet, whose working-class lyrics were infiltrated by a desire for greater freedom in the face of tyranny. The speculative history and fate of Rodriguez, however, was quite more bizarre. Prevailing word on the street in Johannesburg was that Rodriguez had committed suicide in a spectacular fashion, setting himself on fire while on stage. Documentarian Benjaloo does an excellent job of selling the drama, at least initially, only dropping a few hints. He creates a story arc that is quite effective and must be touted for producing such a film with very little funding. Many scenes were even filmed on an iPhone, using an app that produces Super 8-style film stock footage. After the long-hinted-at twist is revealed, the film does less to reassure the viewer, leaving a sense of bitterness and need for revenge. Regardless, the filmmaker does an excellent job of going back to the roots of Sixto's life in Detroit, enabling the mystery by interviewing old acquaintances as well as the producer of Rodriguez's albums. Enlightenment comes when this founder of Motown Records is interrogated politely, leading to a single revelation. Rodriguez was sold out, and his family lived on meager funds for years before the story came to light. Now we have the truth of a man that may have changed the whole world, but for those who grew up in South Africa at the time, the world did change. Inspiration occurred. And now audiences around the world have a chance to see the same inspiring soul in person, on tour, at age 70. Rodriguez has finally been redeemed. Although Benjaloo's account is flawed and eventually fails in some ways, it surely succeeds at telling an amazing story of tragedy and redemption.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary Jane. Sugar Man, met a false friend on a lonely dusty road. Lost my heart when I found it, it had turned to dead black. Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary Jane.
That was Justin Hartwig reviewing Searching for Sugar Man, which debuts on the Starz channel on May 22nd. And it's also running in some theaters in Portland. So hope you can catch it. It sounds like a great documentary. That's it for Stage and Studio. My thanks to engineer Janet Anderson. And if you missed any of the show, you can visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on the facebook.com/stage N Studio. You can also tweet me with your events and updates and comments at @StageNStudio. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts. Let's listen to the rest of Sugar Man by Rodriguez.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For the blue coin, won't you bring back?
For your names, you took hope and humble, black and tan. Your whipped wind of change howled low, blowing itself smack in the middle of Ellington's orchestra. Billy heard it too, and cried strange fruit tears. Your resistance was found in the food that you placed at the master's table. Ha.
Born and raised in Portland, Oregon, the internationally renowned visual artist Carrie Mae Weems is known for her art investigating issues of race, class, and gender. Her show at the Portland Art Museum ends this Sunday. Tune in to KABU on Friday morning at 11 a.m. to hear a talk she gave at the opening of the exhibition in February. That's Carrie Mae Weems, this Friday, May 17th, from 11 a.m. to noon on KABU. More information can be found on the website kboo.fm/Carrie Mae Weems.
Good morning. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus here at KABU. My name is Ava Lake, and I have with me today Sandy Rumagoo. She has a show that is at Blackfish Gallery right now that's in the Pearl, and it runs the whole month of May. The name of the show is Threshold. Sandy, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And you've been on KABU a couple of times, but it was with Julie Bernard?
That's correct.
So, a while.
Yes.
It's been a while.
Quite a while.
Now, first of all, let me ask you, how long have you been a part of Blackfish?
Well, probably off and on almost their entire life. I think they will be celebrating their 35th year. But during the time I left to join Quartersaw until she went out of business,
right.
I didn't, you know, it wasn't my fault.
But I think that might have been my first show that I saw of yours, was at Quartersaw.
And then from there I went to Mark Woolley until he closed.
I remember that too.
Yes.
Did he show the dogs, or was that at Blackfish?
No, he showed the dogs.
He showed the dogs. Okay. All right. But let's talk a little bit about the current exhibition.
Okay.
Threshold. Talk to us about the title.
Well, it's a time in my life where I am thinking about the meaning of that word, which is a point in time whether you either go forward or backward. And symbolically, I wanted to incorporate that into the landscapes that I chose to paint. And also in my own life, where I really welded and married my political life with my artistic life, and that's by running for public office.
Right. So even though we're looking at these paintings that are look like they're Oregon, right?
Yes.
They are landscape or place, let's put it that way.
Yes.
There is a kind of a political content that is behind them.
Yes. And there are a couple of paintings where I address clear cut, which I've done over the years, but I approached it a bit differently. I kind of left out the political message and just painted them pretty much straight on, mm-hmm. because painting them straight on, you get the grisly message.
It was devastating enough.
Yes, exactly.
So that's one of the names, one of the paintings, Logsden Clear Cutting.
Yes.
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 So tell us just a little bit, where was that? How was that?
Okay, all of the paintings, and there are 14 in the show, are based on scenes in Lincoln County. And, of course, Newport's right on the beach, which is where I live. And Logsden is a community that's maybe 10 miles east, right in the Coast Range. And when you drive back on these roads, you can see where these clear-cutting procedures are used. And I just went out there one day driving around, and they had just finished one.
Oh.
And so my response is visceral,
mm-hmm.
and I tend to get angry. And I thought, wow, I just can't let this one pass. But at the same time, the shapes that were in this particular composition of the clear-cut itself, look, because they take just like cookie cutter parts out and just, you know, take
it to
the
buzz.
Yeah, right. So I thought, wow, that is a great shape compositionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so that started the two. So I thought I'd marry, which is what I like to do in my painting. I like to use all of the art history, Renaissance, whatever mm-hmm. history I've learned during my life, and marry it with the technique of painting and the imagery I'm doing.
So when you're addressing something like clear cutting, you kind of have to almost search it out, right? Because we can drive by forests and it's only a little further in that there's something else, right? It's kind of hidden.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And they are required by law, if it's next to a stream or a road, they have to give a buffer zone. But the buffer zone is pretty narrow.
It's getting more and more narrow.
Yes.
And just a little bit about how you do it. Are you drawing out there, or are you photographing, or like how did you make that painting?
Well, first I have to see it. I'm not good at making things up, and by that I mean
those dogs in doing all the crazy things they were doing, that had to have been made up.
Well, not much.
Oh, okay, all right.
So I have to base it on reality. In other words, that's where I have to start, because I find that in reality it's crazier usually than I can make up. So it's my point of view. It's how I have to look at it. And so I look at it. I'm out there at the site. I walk around it. I touch it. I feel it. It's a very hands-on introduction to any subject matter that I do. And then I will do sketches. And how I start the sketches is to break it down into shape. And then value.
And is that out there, or was that
out
in
there?
It was out there.
Because it's usually a time of day, and I'll try to go back to that time of day. There's something about light, the shadow, or something that gives me another shape that I want to use. So then after that, I will go back to the studio and draw again to the size that I want to make the painting.
Mm-hmm. And these are pretty big paintings.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And these are 48. They're all rectangular, so they're 48 inches high by 60 inches wide. That's a favorite size of mine. I just love that size. So I decided, well, I'll just make every painting for this show that size and just love it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so a really, favorite painting or whatever is Kings Valley Barn.
Yes.
And are there two versions, or is this